Science and technology are an increasingly large part of our lives. We take a look at the interface between science and history, economics, philosophy, ethics, religion, and culture. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm your host, Elizabeth Fernandez. Is climate change a one-way street? Can the damage we are dealing to the environment ever be undone? Perhaps the solution is right in front of us. Today we're talking about Project Drawdown, a collection of solutions to stop and even reverse climate change. Particularly, in this podcast, we will discuss transportation. Project Drawdown has several solutions to address how we can rethink how we can get from point A to point B. Dr. Ryan Allard joins us. Ryan is a senior fellow at Project Drawdown, responsible for modeling and integrating various transportation solutions. He is an expert in passenger intermodality and various systems like mass transit, high-speed rail, and electric vehicles. So welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Project Drawdown is a really interesting and a very ambitious idea. So can you give us a little bit of background about what Project Drawdown is?
Yes, certainly. Drawdown is a point in time where concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere begin to decline on a year-to-year basis. And so Project Drawdown was formed around this idea of getting the world to draw down. Project Drawdown is a global coalition. It's based in California, but it has researchers and experts from around the world in a wide variety of areas of expertise. We have people modeling, mapping, and analyzing solutions to climate change. We have persons across several sectors, and it's supported by an advisory group with over 130 advisors around the world. So the coalition has modelers, researchers, scientists, architects, engineers, politicians, business leaders, and others, including those who are experts specifically on climate change, to support this modeling effort. Project Drawdown is also a communications organization to communicate the top solutions to climate change. And one of our major publications published in 2017, titled Drawdown, is a testament to that work. So this is the work we do, and this is what Project Drawdown does.
And so I guess the idea behind Project Drawdown is that climate change isn't actually a one-way street, that we could actually begin to reverse some of the damage done to the climate?
Yes, exactly. So climate change, the word change suggests that, right? It's a change, but not necessarily only up or only down. Mm-hmm. This is something that we can actually control to some extent. Now, the Earth has its own way of responding to certain human impacts, but there are things that we understand about the Earth that we can contribute towards changing now. And so that's why scientific background is very important, because understanding the complexity of the Earth is a very, very detailed process.
Right. And so today we're going to be talking about transportation, but the solutions in Project Drawdown are actually divided up into several different categories. So what are some of these categories?
So we've looked at a wide range of solutions across the world. And we've looked at solutions that are scaling somewhere in the world, solutions that have a business case that somebody believes can actually be adopted somewhere in the world, and solutions that, of course, can actually have an impact on the climate. So when we did this process, we identified several solutions, several hundred solutions, actually. And we had to choose the top 100 in order to focus on. And so our work focuses on the top 100 solutions to climate change. So the categories that we've been able to create from that process include, of course, transportation, but also building and materials, city life, you know, the built environment that most of the world's population lives in. Certainly the population itself, you know, the population growth and, you know, how that is related to things like women's rights and the rights of girls in developing countries, including even energy system. That's probably what we most think about when we think of solutions to climate change, the electricity generation and energy system. But there are certainly many other solutions outside of that sector which are relevant.
What's also unique about this is that some of these solutions, of course, we think about what governments can do and what large companies can do, but some of these solutions are also things that individuals can do too. And wasn't there something like a challenge for people to get involved and to try to implement some of these solutions in their life?
Yes, certainly the solutions that we've modeled span a wide range of what we call agencies, levels of agency. And what that basically means is that the person who can, or the institution that can enact a particular solution, adopt or implement a solution, it varies widely, right? So some of them certainly are at the governmental level. Some of them are at the level of individual companies or households. Many of them are at the level of the land owners. So there are quite a few solutions that are relevant for food and for food production and for land. And what we found is that the farmers, the landowners, the companies that are actually managing food production, they're the ones that take agency there. And so some of the challenges that we've, or the other projects that we've been involved in, are actually to encourage persons to think about their role in contributing towards climate change. Certainly that's a very important aspect.
And so today we're going to be talking about your specialty, which is transportation, and how the transportation will affect climate change as well. And so transportation is actually responsible for a huge amount of emissions that we put into the atmosphere right now. It's something like 23% of emissions. So what are some of the ways that the transportation is affecting our climate?
Well, let's start with how exactly all most types of transportation affect the climate. And that's most often in the production of greenhouse gases from the machines that move us or move goods and service and provide services. And so if you look at, say, a car, you know, internal combustion engine vehicle, we're taking gasoline or diesel, we're burning it, and that exhaust is produced and released in the atmosphere. That exhaust includes a lot of things, things that make city life a bit more difficult, but certainly things that affect the climate. And so one of those things, which is perhaps what most people are familiar with, is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, meaning that it encourages trapping heat within the atmosphere of the Earth to increase the warming of the Earth. And that's not the only one. You also have other gases produced in the exhaust of cars, planes, ferries, boats, etc. And so transportation overall produces greenhouse gases. Now, some of the modes of transportation or types of transportation that most intensely produce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are certainly cars, planes, and modes which are what we call inefficient. Inefficient in the sense that they use a lot of energy to move people and to move goods. So if you look, for instance, at the use of, again, internal combustion engines, you're looking at the use of fuel, right? So gasoline or diesel, and that gasoline or diesel directly produces carbon dioxide when you burn it. If you look at an electric vehicle uses electricity, but that electricity must come from somewhere, mm-hmm. right? So if you're in a country or if you're in a region that uses a lot of coal, for instance, to generate your electricity, then although you are using a relatively efficient energy source, which is electricity, to produce your motion, to get your car moving, the source of that electricity is actually very carbon intensive, which is coal, when you're burning coal to produce electricity. And so those two sides kind of come together to measure or to estimate the impact of a particular type of transportation on the climate, mm-hmm. the energy intensity and the carbon intensity. So other examples would be aircraft. And there's a key impact there of how many people or how much space you're using in these vehicles, right? So if you're traveling in a car by yourself, you're going to be using a lot more energy per person, and a lot more carbon emissions will be emitted per person than if you're traveling in a car with four people or four guests or four passengers. So that's also a very important factor to note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned the electric car, and so talking about the electric car, it's actually interesting. The idea of the electric car is actually quite an old one, right?
Yeah, certainly. It's been around. The idea has been around for several decades. It has been actually in development. And then because of the availability of, or the ease and availability of gasoline and diesel, It was basically abandoned several decades ago, but because of the potential for reducing carbon dioxide emissions, it's seeing that revival. Because there's an important fact to note here, which is the need to carry high density energy sources, right? And what that means is that if you have a particular amount of the energy, you want to be able to get a lot of it in order to move the car, move the plane, move the vehicle that you're talking about. So we've been able to find very few competing sources for fuel that are as energy dense as fuel. And that's why when you have aircraft going, basically all the aircraft that are providing commercial services use fuel, right? Because it's the most energy dense option we have. And so that quickly became the option, the common option. And that's why today we have probably around 90% of all transportation fuel being, all transportation energy sourcing being some sort of fuel from the fossil industry.
When you're talking about electric car, then this, of course, uses electricity. And so you mentioned sometimes electricity might come from coal, which isn't necessarily a clean source. But the whole idea behind an electric car being potentially cleaner is that if you're having your electricity coming from some sort of like renewable source, that would be a better way to go and that would cause less emissions, correct?
Absolutely, yes. Because we have to look at what we call the entire life cycle, the entire process of producing your motion, right? Because you're talking about moving people or moving goods. Mm-hmm. And so from the source of extraction of that energy, whether it's, you know, extracting it from the ground, like in fossil fuels, or in generating it from some source, which it could be fossil fuels, it could be, you know, using wind, could be using solar, all the way down to providing the motion in your vehicle, in your plane, in your boat, etc. You have to look at the entire process that it takes to provide that that motion. Mm-hmm. Some of that is what we might call indirect. So, for instance, when we're producing cars, we're actually looking at using energy sources to produce the shape of the car, to convert materials into the door, into the wheels, into the glass, for instance, and putting them together. And that actually does also create emissions. Those are indirect emissions because they aren't really generated by using the car, all right? But when we use the car, we also put fuel and we create more emissions. So you put them together and that's what you get. And so the source of your energy is very important. And the cleaner the grid, the better it is when you electrify your transportation systems. That's a very important fact.
Right. So I know a lot of people were a little bit reluctant to go to electric vehicles because there was this issue on range that a car couldn't go very far on an individual charge. Now, is this problem being addressed?
Yes, certainly. So what you're mentioning there is called range anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I suppose to put it into context, we think of driving with an internal combustion engine instead of a conventional car as a pretty standard process, right? Now, why we think that way is because every 200 meters, every 200 kilometers, every 100 and something miles, we can easily find a gas station when we're going cross country, for instance, right? Sadly, that's not the case yet with electric vehicles. And so what we have is a potential that we might be left out of luck, right? So we might be able to get a certain distance and not be able to charge our vehicle. Now that's changing slowly. There are two main ways how you can change that. One, of course, is to just have more charging stations, right? There's an issue that you have a regular charging station, which is a regular plug, which you can find in your household, for instance, that you can use to charge your vehicle, but because the voltage is very low, it takes a lot of time to charge it. And so that's also kind of a disadvantage of using an electric vehicle. However, there are also fast chargers, and they may be called DC fast chargers. Many companies have been trying to promote their own brands. And what they do is allow you to charge your vehicle in a much shorter time, maybe only an hour, maybe half an hour, maybe just a few minutes. And there are many other ideas that have been generated and new companies and technologies that are being put on the market. So we'd expect that in the future that that would become less and less of a problem. But a second way that we are kind of reducing that range anxiety is to have more capacity in the batteries, right? So again, because we're taking the energy with us, in this case is not a fuel, but it's a battery. It has electricity. The more electricity we can put into that battery when we're moving, the better it is for our range. And so there's a lot of research, you know, probably the most famous is the Tesla company, but there's a lot of research worldwide on making the batteries much more energy dense, increasing the energy density. And when we are able to get to a level that makes electric vehicles comparable to conventional vehicles, then we'll see a much more rapid adoption of electric vehicles. And that's when, you know, we may even see parity in prices, for instance.
In comparison to a vehicle with traditional fuel, traditional gasoline, are electric vehicles cheaper in the end to operate and to maintain?
That brings up the question of what is called, or what might be called, total cost of ownership, right? So again, this is looking at the entire process of purchasing, maintaining, using the vehicle, and even disposing of it, right? But if you think about it from that perspective, we certainly have to include the cost of fuel for a conventional vehicle, the cost of maintenance, and as I said, the cost of disposal, which might be actually a negative cost because maybe you can sell your vehicle to someone else or to maybe a scrapyard or something, right? So on the electric vehicle side, we're looking again at the cost of purchase, the cost of electricity, and the cost of maintenance. So the cost of purchase we know is tends to be at this stage a bit higher for electric vehicles. However, the cost of maintenance, while there's, you know, there's limited data because we have a lot of data globally on conventional vehicles, but we have more limited data on electric vehicles, right? However, it does seem comparable. It might be even cheaper in some cases because of the simplicity of the motors, right, and the electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. So it might be cheaper. However, the cost of the energy, the cost of the fuel versus the cost of electricity, there's a much bigger difference there. Typically, you would see electricity much at much cheaper prices, right, for moving, let's say, on your daily commute, right? So when you add it up, it really depends on which state in the U.S. you are in, which country you're in, but you can actually see a cheaper price in the long run. That is the total cost of ownership for an electric vehicle. So, but it really depends on the local prices, the local rebates, for instance, and the local cost of your energy.
Switching gears a little bit, another one of the solutions that Project Drawdown has is high-speed rail. And high-speed rail is actually one of the fastest ways to go somewhere, I think between 100 and 700 miles away. So how fast does a high-speed rail train go?
That's a very interesting question because it really depends on who you ask. So the international agency that kind of manages high-speed rail, they say that it must be between or at least 250 kilometers per hour, right? Mm-hmm. And they also say that, okay, it could be at least maybe 200 kilometers per hour in certain sections, right? What you call, or what they call, higher speed rail. And so when we look at that definition, you can see that, for instance, there are very limited parts of the U.S. that you might consider higher speed rail, but maybe the California project would be the first in the U.S. Globally, a lot of the definitions apply to many systems in Europe, a lot in China, and quite a few in other parts of Asia, especially Japan.
Why is this called one of Project Drawdown's solutions? Why is it any cleaner than traditional rail?
Well, the thing about high-speed rail is that it attracts persons that need to go great distances, right? This is not really for urban travel. This is for getting between cities. And when we think about what the options are for people who travel between cities, it tends to be flying, driving, or taking a train. The typical options, right? Now, flying could be a mode that uses, or could be a type of transportation that uses or generates a lot of emissions, of greenhouse gas emissions. But there's some assumptions in that. You know, it depends on how many people are traveling on a particular plane, a particular jet. That is, the more people you have on a jet, the less emissions are produced per person, right? But it's the same thing with a train. The more people you have on a train, the less there are emissions per person. But overall, electricity produces fewer emissions than jet fuel. And so what you find is that high-speed rail produces less emissions per person than flying.
Okay.
Right? And so that's a relatively robust result. You can look at results across the world for that. But again, it does depend on how many people are in your planes and how many people are in your trains. Right? And so what that means is that every time you decide to use a high-speed rail trip versus, say, a plane, then you're actually contributing to making high-speed rail even more efficient, you know, producing fewer emissions. Now, high-speed rail doesn't typically compete with conventional rail because high-speed rail tends to attract, certainly is a higher price. It also allows you to go greater distances within a comparable, you know, depending on the length of the trip, obviously, but a comparable time to aviation, right? And so if you're looking at distances up to 200, 300, 400 miles, they can compete, you know. Past that distance, high-speed rail tends to be a lot more travel time, tends to require a lot more travel time. And so it sometimes doesn't compete as well with flights.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are only something like 28 miles of high-speed rail in the U.S., and I think that might depend on, like you said, your definition of what high-speed rail is. So why is there not very much high-speed rail in the United States?
Well, if you look at the countries where high-speed rail is, it's flourishing, right? You tend to see a lot of government-led investment. And the U.S. tends to resist that investment for high-speed rail or for rail in general, right? The U.S. is a very large country, and that is another reason that generates resistance to investment. There's a lot of density requirements for high-speed rail to be attractive. Right. So you need to have a lot of people living in a very dense corridor, which is why you'd see the system that's closest to the international definition of high speed rail is in one of the most dense areas of the US, right? So the Boston Washington corridor. And, you know, that area has, you know, on the order of 50 million people, right? So if you're looking at areas that are less dense, then high speed rail is going to have to, it's going to be a bit costly to invest in high speed rail versus, say, flying. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are the two main reasons, you know, the top-down public investment and the perception that that leads to in the U.S. versus, say, the Europe, which is more accepting of government-led investment in public transportation, and certainly in Asia, as well as the density requirement to make high-speed rail from a financial and an economic perspective very attractive.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that makes sense that the places you see the most high-speed rail are places like Western Europe and Japan and parts of China, that there is a lot of population density as well.
Exactly, certainly so. And if you look, for instance, along the islands of Japan, you see immense density along the tracks, you know, along the route of high-speed rail. Another thing that's relatively important for high-speed rail development and economic attractiveness is how the urban developments are formed. Because if you notice, because we're talking about basically lines of transportation, you know, there's one track or two tracks that are built between cities. Ideally, you want to have cities that kind of can be aligned in that way. And so that's why it works in Japan, because you have a lot of cities that are formed in this linear fashion. Similarly, in the Boston-Washington corridor, you have cities that are more or less lined up. But if you have a star network, if you have cities scattered in a different pattern, it makes the high-speed rail alignment very different and may actually increase the costs of implementing and operating the high-speed rail.
And moving from that into things like mass transit, again, I imagine that the places that mass transit are probably work the best are the places that have the highest population density. Is that in general what you see?
That is absolutely the case, yes. And so you see many cities around the world, quite a few in Asia, certainly in Europe. There's some in the US where you have sufficient density to make mass transit very, very attractive financially, economically. But that's only one aspect of mass transit, because when you have people moving by any type of mass transit, because there's several types, you know, you have metros and subways, you have buses, you have bus rapid transit, which are kind of a more dedicated busways, etc. And you have other types, right? So when you have people moving by these modes or these approaches, then you have fewer people in cars. That's a different measure of efficiency that's been expressed. It's called space efficiency, right? Because you have dense cities and you have a lot of people moving in many different directions, many different ways, you ideally want to have many people using less space when they're being transported, right? And so when you have a lot of people on a train, that takes up a lot less space than a lot of people taking cars individually. And so that's a very key point also. And so in big cities, even medium cities, mass transit is very attractive for those reasons. It's certainly, you know, from a climate perspective, it reduces emissions, but it also is more efficient or more efficient use of the space, the limited space in very dense cities.
Do you think that there are certain things that can be done or certain aspects that can make mass transit very appealing for cities to start implementing them more and more?
Certainly. There are a lot of agencies working around the world to promote mass transit and promote what it is and what it can do for a city. Certainly, it can reduce, you know, noise pollution, air pollution, the climate as we discussed. But mass transit is a word that covers many different things. So I gave an example before, right, of the subways, the metros, and the buses. But it also includes anything that gets people to move collectively rather than move individually, right? So if you look in some developing countries, for instance, there's a much more extensive use of minivans to get people around. And what it allows is that individuals can own the minivans, and once they're coordinated in a certain way, you have a lot more, certainly, space efficiency, but you also allow economic development, you know, because you could basically have small companies or micro enterprises being developed. You know, someone can own two or three buses and they can have a small business that thrives, that provides a public service, that interacts with the government and the individuals, the people who live in the city. And so that's certainly something that can be a benefit in addition to the others I mentioned. In the developed world, you tend to have a lot more of the state-led investment for mass transit systems with very good coordination, very good management of systems. And so that allows you to integrate well across the city, right? That's a very important thing for a big city. You want to be able to respond to issues in any part of the city. You want to be able to adapt to events that may draw a lot of attendees without having excessive congestion and all of the ills, the urban ills that brings. So there are a lot of attractive things that mass transit brings currently. But the issue with mass transit really is that sometimes it doesn't attract the travelers sufficiently. And that's where the big gap lies sometimes. Cities have realized that people need to want to get out of their cars in order to use mass transit, right? And so getting them out of their cars could be challenging sometimes. It depends on cultural aspects. It depends on the purpose of their trips, for instance. If I'm traveling to go to work, and I need to go outside of the city, then perhaps I decide I'm going to use my car. If, however, I'm going to an event in the city, maybe I decide that I will use the subway because it's just more convenient. And so you have a lot of different aspects that affect which option of transportation we choose. So the challenge for cities is to make the mass transit option be the most attractive for most people most of the time. And there are a lot of research articles and, you know, different projects around the world on how best to do that, whether it's improve marketing, improve comfort of the systems, improve integration with your cell phone so I know exactly when the train or the bus is coming. I don't need to wait in the sun too long. And all of these types of things are available. And the great thing is that they are having an impact. But we need certainly more adoption and more promotion of these approaches.
Right, right. And as far as airplanes go, people, of course, there are going to continue to fly, but what kind of things are being done to make airplane travel and air travel a little bit more carbon neutral?
It really depends. The carbon intensity, the amount of emissions that you produce by flying, really depends on the number of people in the plane, right? So if I have a 100-seater plane and I only fill 50 seats, I'm still taking those empty seats with me, and the plane is a huge machine. And so that takes a lot of energy and emissions. So one of the key things that already has been done is to just put more people in planes, right? And so this is something that airlines realize actually makes them more money, right? They reduce their costs if they need fewer planes, and they get more people on their planes, so they get more fare money. global revenue. And so that revenue management has been invested in by airlines for several decades already, and they've optimized that quite a bit, which is why you'd see many flights that are pretty packed. So the next stage really is to look at other alternatives, right? Some of these alternatives that are most famous are to use different fuels, in particular biofuels. This is not a solution that we're able to analyze in detail in Project Drawdown because of the interaction with land. Biofuels are basically fuels that have some component grown from some plant, some natural product, right? Typically, it's, you know, we've talked, for instance, in the, you know, in the sphere of urban cars, there's a lot, or there used to be a lot of talk about using ethanol, for instance, as one of the ingredients in the fuel used. And so it's a similar idea for aircraft. And there are many different types of biofuels and many projects taking place around the world to stimulate investment and generate new types of biofuels. Mm-hmm. But the challenge with aircraft is that the amount of biofuel you need is so significant that if it interacts or if it takes away cropland and materials that you might use for feeding people, then you have a conflict. Right. And so... Right. There's a lot of research in trying to find waste inputs to create biofuels. Try to use degraded land, which wouldn't be used for feeding people anyway, to create biofuels. And so that area of research is still pretty nascent, pretty new. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to find very efficient ways of producing that type of fuel for aircraft. But there are other approaches being used, whether it's technological, such as designing aircraft slightly differently to increase aerodynamics. So you reduce the amount of energy use, or fuel you use to move the aircraft through the air, or even the management of the airspace where aircraft are flying, right? So the US and Europe are investing in next generation aviation management systems that will allow that to be much more efficient. So we can pack more planes into the same airspace. So we can have aircraft landing without needing as much fuel to land. Right. And there are other approaches, but that's an overview of the aviation sector in terms of reducing the emissions from flying.
When you're talking about transportation, another solution is to just not have to travel at all. And a lot of interesting things are coming about, as in a lot of companies now are encouraging their employees to work from home or to work from various parts of the country. And there are these things called telepresences and virtual reality that's helping people do that.
Well, this could be a tremendously important part. The best way to reduce transportation emissions is to not travel at all, basically. However, we have to think about what transportation is. Transportation is an economic activity. We travel for a reason, right? We travel to earn money, to spend money. We travel to see people we haven't seen. We travel to have meetings. We travel to do things. And so the traveling itself is generally, not always, but generally not the purpose, right? No, sometimes you may take your car and just go on the open road to enjoy the trip. But for most reasons, for most of the time, we travel to do something. And so this idea of avoiding that completely is about doing that thing, whatever that thing is, you know, whether it's working or it's meeting, without traveling, right? So we have a lot of new technologies that allow that, right? So telepresence is one example. We have virtual reality. We have Skype. We have Zoom. We have all these online technologies. And so if we can avoid traveling altogether, we can actually have a huge impact on the environment, huge impact on the climate, and certainly on the congestion and the air quality in the cities.
And we're doing this right now because Ryan and I are not in the same room. We're talking from across the country to one another. So
exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. In addition to finding us on facebook.com/sparkdialogue and on Twitter @sparkdialogue, we're also now on Pinterest. Just go ahead and search for Spark Dialogue Podcast. Also, you can find show notes and past episodes at sparkdialogue.com. And if you haven't subscribed to or rated the podcast yet, and you need a little help in doing so, I've made a little walkthrough on how to do so on places like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and so on. And you can find this at sparkdialogue.com/how-to-subscribe. Oh, and we're also now on Spotify, so that's another great place that you can listen to this podcast. This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and as always, thanks for listening.